start. Welcome. I'm very, very pleased to be chairing this book launch, an introduction of Heide Gerstenberger's work. And so I'm going to introduce the speakers and just give you a broad kind of setup of the talk today. My name is Maya Powell, and I'm one of the editors on the board. And so Heide Gerstenberger, which probably don't need much introducing, but a retired professor in Germany of state and social theory. Theory of the state and society. It's been a long day. And we have, so Heide will speak for 25 minutes, introducing her new work. And we have then two discussants, Jasper Stange, which is badly written in the programme, I'm very sorry, and who is a student activist in Berlin. And then we have Andrew Wright, who teaches international political economy in the UK and who was one of the founding editors of HM. So good to see some a bit of heritage, I guess, for the journal.
That's how it starts.
Okay, without further ado, Heide, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Marx's analysis of the basic structures of capitalism explain why, once established by blood and dirt, the capital relation can be reproduced in social forms which appear to confirm the absence of brutal force and sometimes even the existence of mutual interest. If labor contracts have existed before the advent of capitalism, it is only with capitalism that the contract has developed into the ideological center of capitalist forms of production. Any doubt about its relevance was obliterated by the movement for the abolition of slavery. In making contracts into the defining characteristic of non-slavery, abolitionists gifted capitalism with a powerful vindication of its specific forms of exploitation. Its ongoing relevance is present in all the contracts which, starting in the last decades of the 19th century and continuing until today, have been falsified in order to prevent legal action against forced labor. By insisting on the ongoing presence of brute force in capitalist forms of appropriation, I do not want to minimize the sufferings to be experienced in labor conditions which are considered regular. Instead, I endeavor to explain that the historical realities of capitalism do not adhere to Marx's conceptions of history. If direct violence against person is indeed no longer a necessity for the reproduction of capitalist social forms of production, it has and is nevertheless constantly made use of. Quite a few Marxists endeavor to reconcile Marx's statement about the transition from the phase of so-called primitive accumulation to the ordinary run of things in capitalism by declaring that primitive accumulation, i.e. the presence of brutal force, was not restricted to a certain phase of capitalism, but is one of its ongoing characteristics. If this is certainly correct as far as historical realities are concerned, there's no way around the fact that Marx thought differently. And this is not the only example where his philosophy of history has intruded into his analysis. Indeed, it is constantly present in Marx's explanations of those developments of capitalism which will produce the preconditions for the better future to which mankind is destined. That these explanations have not been validated by the actual course of history has to be accepted as critique of any theoretical concept which links structural analysis to concepts of historical teleology. It is this linkage which provoked my research into the historical functioning of capitalism. Its result can be summed up in a nutshell. It runs as follows. Exceptions apart, owners of capital make use of all the means to achieve profits which are open to them in a certain place and at a certain time. If direct violence is not one of the practices which are being made use of, This is not prevented by economic rationality, but only by public critique and state activity. I will try to explain some of the findings of this research by relating them to its most vexing theoretical problem. If the resume allows for exceptions, and rightly so, it nevertheless states that capital owners tend to act in certain ways. At first sight, this makes my account into an extensive illustration of Marx's concept of character masks. But this concept refers to actors in as far as they exist in theoretically explained relations to other actors, be these relations of competition, of opposites, or of the contradiction which is present in any form of capitalist exploitation. It is one of the great achievements of Marx to have explained exploitation as resulting from the systemic characteristics of capitalism and not from the more or less vicious character of individuals. But as soon as we leave structural analysis and turn to historical realities, we are no longer confronted with character masks, but with real human beings. And these are not one-dimensional, but pluriel. The term l'homme pluriel was coined by Bernard Lalire in order to explain his reservations about Pierre Bourdieu's concept of habitus. While the concept of habitus is not to be mistaken as a modernized version of Marx's character mask, it is, nevertheless, more closely related to the latter than sociologists' concept of role. In any case, if the owners of capital have to be considered just as pluriel as any other human being, but have nevertheless most of the time acted as if they were the character masks of structural analysis, then we have to look for explanations of their behavior which are not sufficiently contained in structural analysis of capitalism. And of course, no Marxist worth his or her ilk will have recourse to concepts of the fundamentally egoistic nature of human beings. If my exposition of historical developments goes back to the 15th and 16th century, this is not to recant from insisting that capitalism did not start with the world market. Instead, I offer an addition to Marx's analysis of the so-called previous accumulation, which may help to explain the historical foundation of long-lasting patterns of legitimating violence. When starting in the 15th century, a European-based world market more or less replaced the Asian-based world market of the 13th and 14th century, this amounted to the replacement of a network of more or less peaceful trade, with some occurrences of robbing and killing, by a system of regular robbery with some occurrences of peaceful trade connections. European armed trade was a threat to everyone, including merchants which held trading privileges from competing European princes. If legitimating violence with the task of Christianization was still present in the early phases of a European-based world market, much later to be reformulated as an obligation to civilize, we may detect a legacy from the armed trade of pre-capitalism to capitalism which has nothing to do with any merchant capital that may have been accumulated. In granting trading privileges to merchants, European princes also took on the responsibility for all the bloodshed which was being practiced in order to gain the profits which they themselves expected. The direct responsibility of political powers for the practice of violence in the processes of appropriation has been present in each and every colonial state to have been erected by any capitalist state. The most important contribution to these practices was the legal transformation of subjugated men and women into natives, to be legally treated as human beings of minor worth. Colonial states were simply that, institutions for forcing natives to help exploit the natural riches of their home countries. On the other hand, societies on their way to become examples of metropolitan capitalism came to be governed by apparatus which revolutionaries had declared to be the property of nations. In defining the difference between legality and illegality, these governments thereby also outlined the range of practices citizens could feel justified to make use of. Laws entitle citizens to overlook the possible contradiction of their practices with those concepts of natural law which had encouraged bourgeois revolutionaries. If, according to dominant interpretation, any such contradiction was obliterated by contracts, this justification nevertheless excluded slavery. But the founders of the United States managed to include slavery into the political structures of the Union by counting slaves as 3/5 of an inhabitant of these of slave states in order to increase the number of representatives of these states in Congress. They invented a pattern of bourgeois ethical hypocrisy which denies any bounds to the dominion of private property. If there were, not only internationally but also in the United States, more and more men and women who criticized slavery, this does not seem to have affected slavers. Instead, their representative neighborhoods and later on also the respective state legislations even came to prohibit the practice of giving a slave with his or her freedom at the death of his or her owner. I mentioned this development in order to suggest that in explaining actual behavior of capital owners, we not only take into consideration economic interests and the existing legal framework, but also the outlooks which are dominant in a historically given neighborhood. The social force which I tentatively term neighborhood existed and exists in many varieties. If the neighbors or slavers were more or less living nearby, today's neighborhoods can also consist of the leading or not so leading employees of a multinational combine. It is in these neighborhoods that competition has been elevated to the range of an ethical norm. Accordingly, most anything seems to be accepted amongst these neighbors as long as it is practiced for the best of the firm. But let's go back to slavery. According to Marx and many Marxists, slavery would have had to be abolished sooner or later because it was preventing further development of capitalism. But nowhere has slavery been abolished because it prevented profitable production. The most convincing argument against the assumption that free wage labor is a structural necessity for the development of capitalism, however, was provided by all those capital owners who, immediately after the abolishment of legal slavery, invented and exploited legal forms of surrogate slavery. Amongst them was the extensive trade in labor contracts, which bound Asian coolies to their places of work for a number of years and very often for much longer. Once again, this trade was not abolished because of economic irrationality. Instead, it was ended by the governments of sending countries after reports about the slave-like labor conditions to which coolies were subjugated abroad could no longer be overlooked. While in the USA and in colonies, slave-like labor was predominant in agrarian capitalism, it was also present in industrial capitalism. Though legal forms of bondage were not as frequent in Europe as elsewhere, they were not absent. Marx knew about the fact that leaving a work without the consent of the capital owner was considered a criminal offense in England, thereby limiting contractual freedom even in the most advanced industrialized country. When he refrained from discussing this fact, Marx may have assumed that this criminal law would necessarily be abolished in the course of capitalist development. But when it was indeed abolished in 1875, this was not because of any widespread preference for a free labor market, but because the finally achieved extension of suffrage had offered organized laborers the chance to voice political demands during the electoral campaign. That even in the early 1870s, many English capitalists profited from the criminalization of the so-called breach of contract is just one of the countless examples which prove that, exceptions apart, capitalists make use of any possibility to make profits in a certain time and at a certain place. It was only after World War II that in all of the metropolitan capitalist societies, contractual freedom for laborers was definitely established. Trade unions were accorded the right to deliberate working conditions, thereby reducing the vagaries of individual labor contracts. In terming these developments the domestication of capitalism, I want to stress that if the ferocity of capitalism may be temporarily subdued, it will not disappear, but threaten to once again come forward as soon as vigilance is neglected. The labor regime of National Socialism, which was instituted after capitalism in Germany had already made inroads into its domestication, is a gruesome reminder of the political economy of capitalism. On the international scale, its relevance was once again proven correct by recent threats to formerly established labor rights. Capitalism became globalized when, after the breakdown of the international monetary system, governments of metropolitan capitalist societies abolished restrictions to international movements of capital. This not only furthered the developments of financial markets, it also facilitated investment in production in foreign countries, thereby creating internationalized labor markets in heretofore unknown forms. If this has not completely eradicated the power of labor organizations to demand certain state policies, it certainly reduced their influence. In non-metropolitan capitalist societies, as well as in the worldwide shipping business, the situation is worse, because the existence of a potentially unlimited supply of laborers discourages struggles against violent practices of exploitation. While my research was mainly focused on violence in the exploitation of laborers, I have also referred to recently expanding practices like the trade in body parts, the dumping of poisonous waste, the grabbing of land, or the trade in military power. There's no question about their disastrous effect on the health and even the life of persons. I nevertheless suggest that, just as illegality, violence tends to be politically and hence historically defined. I term violent any form of labor exploitation which prevents laborers to leave their place of work, be this the result of some sort of falsified contract, of threats against the respective laborer or his and her relatives, the practice of imprisoning laborers by employing guards, building fences or barring windows and doors, not to forget the practice of refusing shore leave to seamen for weeks and even months. One has to add conditions which force laborers to work for very long hours and to endure risk to their health without protection. I describe numerous examples, but I also point out that since the founding of the International Labour Organization in 1919, one convention after another has defined what practices are internationally deemed to be unacceptable. In condemning certain practices, these conventions also define the range of capitalist exploitation which is deemed acceptable. National sovereignty ensures that neither the ratification of conventions nor the actual implementation, can be enforced by international conventions. In the 1990s, the ILO adjusted its policies to the conditions of globalization. It now endeavors to at least secure the establishment of basic labor rights. But the chances to attain these rights are reduced when governments advertise offshore conditions of law on the world market for such conditions in order to attract foreign investors. Just like the offshore spheres of financial transactions and for flags of convenience, offshore spheres of production are legal spheres which are constituted as exceptions from national law. If all of them offer special tax conditions, many conditions are being deliberated between potential investors and respective governments. Until very recently, it was common for investors to demand that trade union membership was prohibited for their employees. Recently, such regulations have become less frequent, but the practice has not. Notwithstanding the fact that in creating offshore spheres, governments engage in trade with national sovereignty, they remain officially responsible for conditions in offshore spheres, thereby formally exonerating capital owners from the stigma of direct political domination. By offering capital owners the chance to leave the sphere of law in which their economic units are based, they are also presented with the possibility to flee the eyes of a critical local and national public, instead practicing what Marx has called capitalism sans phrase. Offshore spheres of production are nationally constituted. At the same time, they are integrated elements of the globalized political economy of capitalism. If the class relation exists in any form of capitalism, and if it is present in most social struggles of our time, the classes which Marx assumed would organize and teach themselves, thereby getting ready for revolution, are not present in globalized capitalism. There is then no social force which will induce capital owners to overcome short-sighted practices of exploitation by creating labor conditions which, according to Marx, embody the historical progress inherent in capital social forms of production, because they obliterated the brute force of exploitation characteristic of historically earlier forms of production, and also because they bring about the preconditions for social revolution. The continuing presence of direct violence in capitalist social forms of production contradicts Marx's expectation of the history of capitalism. It thereby also contradicts his theory of revolution. Thank you.
All right. Well, so first of all, of course, I want to say thank you for giving me the chance to comment on Heide's great book. Here, I've had the opportunity to read it in German already, so after Heide has given you an overview of what the book looks at and what its main arguments are, I thought it could be my role to dive into some detail of the empirical work, which I will do by reconstructing the argument of one of the chapters I found the most enlightening but also most fun to read. So I'll first do that to try to give you an idea or an example of how the analysis in the book works, and then I'll finish off with some short theoretical remarks and some suggestions for further research. Before that, I just quickly want to say that the first reason why I looked forward to this book and thought it was so great was because it is, in my opinion, a book that comes exactly at the right time. So in recent years, we have seen an impressive amount of literature dealing with all kinds of aspects of the history of capitalism from writers of all kinds of political and intellectual backgrounds. Some of you may know a recent book edited by Jürgen Kocka and Marcel van der Linden, which is titled Capitalism, The Reemergence of a Historical Concept. And I think that Heide's book is a very timely intervention into this re-emerging debate. And while leftist historians have definitely done a very remarkable job at questioning our understanding of the nature and the development of capitalism in the last couple of years, so you could think of some of the books that historical materialism has published on this matter, I think that Heide's book stands out because she tackles most explicitly some of the problems that with Nancy Fraser we could call the hidden abodes of Marxism, but also of theories of capitalism in general. So I think that this is a great contribution to this debate, and I think that a lot of historians can learn a lot from this book. I certainly did, and it really deserves to be read and debated widely. So one of the questions that have been debated a lot in this so-called new history of capitalism of recent years is the relation of slavery and capitalism in the U.S., and Heide has said something already about that, but I just wanted to give you an idea of what Heide's take on this is, and then use it as an example of some of for some of the merits of the book, as well as for some suggestions. While slavery for a long time has been considered a pre-capitalist form of labor relation that would ultimately be abolished in favor of a capitalist rationality, this understanding may have slightly changed in recent decades and certainly in recent years, but nonetheless, even when confronted with evidence that slavery was indeed profitable in a lot of places and certainly never was abolished because of economic capitalist rationality, it is often claimed that slavery would have basically withered away even without the Civil War. And the main argument in favor of this thesis is the claim that slavery was an obstacle for the implementation of industrial production in the southern states of the U.S. And Heide refutes all of the arguments this thesis is based on. For example, it is often claimed that slavery was mutually exclusive to industrial production because of the lack of labor markets and the mobility of labor in general. And